You're listening to this podcast, so I know you care about the war in Israel right now. And you've been reading the headlines. Massacre in Gaza. Genocide perpetrated by Hamas. No, by Israel. But if you've been listening to this podcast long enough, you know one thing. This stuff seems complicated. And honestly, no one can really just pick a side or decide an opinion without really learning, without really knowing what you're talking about. And that's where this podcast comes in. Check out Unpacking Israeli History, now in its sixth season. They have episodes with topics ranging from what is Hamas anyway, to whether Israel should ransom captured soldiers, and the history of Israel and its disengagement from Gaza in 2005. Unpacking Israeli History cuts through the noise and helps you understand Israel's present through understanding Israel's history. So, educate yourself. Learn the history behind the headlines. Find Unpacking Israeli History wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Amanda Borshaldan. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining me. Today is Thursday, January 21st, and we have a new leader of the free world. This is today's Daily Briefing. I'm joined by our founding editor, David Horowitz, and our U.S. correspondent, Jacob Magid.
Hey, Amanda.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Really a pleasure. Today, we're going to discuss, among other things, the Biden inauguration. There was much pomp and circumstance, a lot of messaging going on as well.
We must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue, rural versus urban, conservative versus liberal. We can do this if we open our souls instead of hardening our hearts, if we show a little tolerance and humility, and if we're willing to stand in the other person's shoes, as my mom would say, just for a moment, stand in their shoes. Because here's the thing about life. There's no accounting for what fate will deal you.
David, what do you have to say about the long Biden speech?
I thought, you know, Joe Biden, I don't think he would claim that he's a charismatic speaker particularly, but it was a very sensible and passionate speech. It didn't duck the challenges that America is facing. And it was actually quite specific about some of the measures that Biden, in fact, since that speech has already begun taking, and the wider imperative to try to heal America. You know, it touched on the key points. I think certainly compared to other people who could have been standing there, that America is fortunate to have somebody with experience, sincerity, and a sort of conciliatory approach. This is somebody who is a political conciliator, which might be very frustrating to people who are strongly ideological. But in a country as riven, where tens of millions of people do not believe that he's won the election, and where the overwhelming majority of the other big party has chosen to go along to a greater or lesser extent with that false narrative of what played out, the challenge of healing and conciliation is certainly would seem to be the key challenge for an American president right now.
There's also the pandemic that changed the setup of the event. And as opposed to under Trump, where you saw lots of people without masks at events and people very close together, now in this event, the people were spread out and there was Bernie Sanders kind of sitting there. And he was seen with his big Vermont coat and gloves. And throughout the day, there were all these amazing memes that were put out showing him in different situations in that same mode. My favorite one there was a meme that said, Minion starts at 7:45. I'm here at 7:45. He's just sitting there in that chair. Really great. There are some really funny memes. I don't know if you guys
also
saw. I agree
entirely. And, you know, the Jewish mother in me was just saying the whole time, why are these people not wearing hats? It is freezing outside. They're all going to catch colds. This is just horrible. I found it very interesting that within Biden's speech, he invoked at least two religious themes. One was quoting from St. Augustine, who is, of course, a Catholic saint, and Joe Biden is famously the second Catholic to be president of the United States. And his other quotation was from Psalm 30, in which he said, "Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning," which is, of course, from the Hebrew Bible. Very interesting to have such a faith-driven theme within this inaugural speech, I thought. David?
Well, yeah, there was a third reference in a way, which is he ascribed to his mother. We need to open our souls in that sentence. He said, "We have to be willing to stand in the other person's shoes," as my mum would say, which is the, you know, is the, this golden rule, you know, the famous Jewish parable of somebody asking Hillel the elder to sum up Judaism while he stood on one foot. And it was basically, don't do unto others what you wouldn't want done to yourself. And all the sort of variations on that, you know, go down the millennia in all kinds of religious and other traditions. So he was seeking, you know, wider inspiration and context and unifying principles, and rightly so.
And yet, in his first order of business, essentially, he undid much of what Trump had done in his term. Jacob, any thoughts on what was undone?
Yeah, we're talking about over a dozen executive orders that undid, for example, the travel ban from Muslim-majority countries. That was something that actually a few Jewish organizations, such as the American Jewish Committee, really praised. HIAS, which works with refugees, also was very happy about that move. His return to the Paris Climate Accord, which is something that Trump had left. That was Obama's initiative that Biden obviously was participant in. He stopped the Trump's U.S.-Mexico border wall. The return to the WHO, the World Health Organization, really a long list of things on the first day that he said he was going to do.
And there are also several things that Trump left undone. And so the question is, will this get done, such as the Abraham Accords? You wrote a very interesting piece about two countries who are in the docket potentially to be included in the next stage. But now there's an even larger question mark. Tell us about that.
Right. So I've been speaking with Trump officials over the past couple weeks, trying to get a feel of where they were at, if there was still time to make more progress, to have another big announcement like we were seeing for the past 4 months, basically, from August to December, of all these countries that were normalizing, whether there was still chance to get more done. As time got closer to January 20th, that became evident that wasn't the case, but I thought it would still be interesting to find out what could have been if we had more time. And two of those countries that we learned were next in line were Mauritania and Indonesia. And Mauritania is even said to be weeks away, this small Muslim country, and Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, were next in line. And the folks I spoke to in the Trump administration said that these are the work is still able to be done. It doesn't have to be Trump that does it. And there's a lot of hope from them that Biden will continue in this work. And Biden's folks, including Tony Blinken, and as recently as Tuesday, kind of talked about that this was something that he supports and is happy to continue working on. However, there is a change in priorities, and Biden made it clear in his inauguration speech and in the comments he's made since in the executive orders that his priorities right now are very much focusing on the pandemic and getting that under control from a health perspective, from an economic perspective, and even just foreign policy-wise, in the Middle East, the priority is more the return to the Iran deal. None of that necessarily negates also working to advance normalization, but there's clearly going to be a reset in that world.
So you mentioned, Jacob, that it doesn't need to be a partisan issue. And yet, David, Throughout the Trump administration, there's been more and more allegations that support for Israel is basically now turned into a partisan issue because of various things, including the maneuverings of our Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and his ambassador to the U.S., who just stepped down, Ron Dermer. Do you have any idea of whether this pendulum can swing the other way, or frankly, whether it has turned into a partisan issue?
I think on that, again, in the same way that I think America is fortunate to have somebody whose instincts are conciliatory as president, I think Israel will have cause to feel the same. The pendulum swings, and it could have swung quite differently on the Democratic side. There were Democratic candidates who were even hostile to Israel and certainly ill-informed about Israel. And instead, the person who became president is extremely well-informed about Israel. I don't think he would dispute for a second that he's a Zionist. There are going to be disagreements. There are going to be disagreements over the Palestinians, over settlements, and there's a great big open disagreement already, as we see, over Iran. And that's a really big issue. But they're going to be tackled, shall we say, between Jerusalem and a Zionist ally in the White House. I'm not playing those down, but I do think in terms of the consequence of this incredibly close relationship between the Israeli leadership and the Trump administration, which ended with the president in such ignominy, the fact that it's Biden now means that the adjustment is doable. I mean, friction, personal tensions, you name it, I'm sure. But the potential for Israel to sustain its crucial bipartisan support is immensely larger, given that it's President Joe Biden rather than almost any of the other likely contenders.
Jacob, you wrote a really interesting, very in-depth, very long piece
there
about Ron Dermer.
You can say it.
And about the allegation that potentially he did influence the American political system to be more partisan in terms of its support for Israel. How did he do that? And do you think he really did do that?
So I think there's two schools of thought, and this gets down to whether he did or not. There's two schools of thought. One says that the importance of maintaining a bipartisan support for Israel in the U.S. is a national strategic interest. And there's another school of thought that says, well, yes, it's nice and we'll pay lip service to it, but at this point there is trends in the U.S. that are changing, and the Democratic Party is on its way out in terms of support for Israel, and therefore we need to bet our chips on the party that is still moving in the other direction, that is still confidently pro-Israel, confidently pro-Netanyahu. And that is what Democrats say that Dermer decided to bet on, that second camp.
I think, apropos of this, one of the quotes that you brought was from Michael Oren. Can you recap his quote?
Michael Oren basically says that Dermer saw his role as being an ambassador for the Netanyahu government to the White House, as opposed to Michael Oren, who is his predecessor, who saw his role as being the ambassador of the Israeli people to the American people. Slightly different takes. And Oren says there's nothing wrong with the job that Dermer did, and that the role that he believed he had, and he did it very effectively. But they are two different roles.
So Iran is definitely one of the hot topics. There are actually many Jews who are going to be in pivotal positions, including Wendy Sherman, who was in the initial negotiations for the Iran deal. I heard yesterday just randomly a conversation with Yuval Steinitz, who talked about how she is such a good friend of Israel, a real good Jew, and definitely trying to do her best by us. Did you see that in the past, and do you think that will be the case in the future? David.
Look, the Obama administration negotiated a deal that Netanyahu let's focus on Netanyahu for a second. Netanyahu thought was a terrible deal, a grave mistake, lobbied against it in the U.S. Congress. Wendy Sherman was part of the team. There's a real, I don't know if it's legitimate, because I think it's incomprehensible personally, but I assume we have to say legitimate difference on this between Israel and the key friend of Israel in the Obama era and apparently in the Biden era. And by the way, it impacts on the Abraham Accords. It's all very well to say we want to keep going with these normalization deals, but they are at least partly a consequence of the sense that America and Israel are going to face down Iran. So say some Gulf states, we'd like to throw in our lot with that America and Israel. If America is now seeking a return to the Iran deal, and we don't know the specifics of the terms on which that would happen, but it is openly seeking to do that, there'll be less... I suppose readiness to take risks by some others in the Middle East of facing off against Iran and incurring all kinds of consequences if America is not reliably firm. So you know all these things play into this. You know, a friend of Israel, a lovely Jewish person. You know, those are going to be motivating factors, I'm sure. But you look at the consequence. You look at what happened in the Obama era, and you look at what is apparently, you know, potentially going to happen in the Biden era. Now, it's not every Israeli who thinks that this deal was a disaster. There are some, including in the security establishment, who think it was the best deal that could have been done, and that the world, notably including Israel, was better off for it having been done. You know, this is we're talking here. So personally, I don't share that assessment, but I'm not, the ultra-informed, high-ranking security official. It seems to me that you have to play the long game against Iran. You have to mistrust them. You have to take them seriously when they speak about their desire to see Israel eliminated and their hostility towards the United States. And the deal did not halt their program. It didn't halt their research on the program. So, you know, personally, I have a huge problem with it. And I would hope that the relationship... I know this is a long answer, but the relationship between Israel and the Biden administration will be more effective than the relationship between Israel and the Obama administration in clarifying why so many smart people in Israel think that the re-entering the deal approach on any kind of similar basis is plain wrong.
And part of that will have to do with how Netanyahu responds to the Biden's plans, as in will he take this more confrontational approach that he felt Obama was also taking towards him, or will he try to work these disagreements out behind closed doors? And what we're kind of seeing already is that it seems to be that Netanyahu prefers the more confrontational approach, in that he's already come out and said very publicly multiple times, both he and his ambassador, that returning to the deal if Iran complies would be a mistake. And now there was a report last night on the main Israeli TV news channel, basically from a senior Israeli official saying that if Biden plans to return to the deal, there's nothing for us to talk about.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jacob. You're exactly right. The early signs are certainly that Netanyahu is not taking the let's resolve this behind closed doors approach.
And this is after Biden, his Secretary of State nominee, Tony Blinken, said we're happy to talk with the Israelis beforehand, not after the fact, which is exactly what Dermer had asked for.
And which is the opposite of Obama. The big complaint, or one of the many complaints, felt in Israel was that Obama said, you don't know what's in the deal, why are you objecting to it? And then when it was done, well, there was no deal that would have satisfied you anyway. I mean, that was, you know, I'll be polite here and say somewhat unfair.
Yeah, exactly. But what's funny now is that if the top U.S. Israeli official is clearly probably close to Bibi, I was telling Channel 12 that there's nothing for us to talk about, even if you're going to the deal, then, okay, so then we don't need to talk beforehand either. So it's a little bit, both sides don't really seem to be on the same page on this.
Well, it's definitely the start of a new chapter, if not a clean slate or a clean page, and we have much to talk about in the future. Thank you so much for joining me, and we'll speak again soon. Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. A special thanks to our producer, Raoul Woodliff. I'm Amanda Borshaldan.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And on our mothership, thetimesofisrael.com.